Жулики, которые занимаются...
Я считаю, что мы победили.
Цель акции очень простая. Она заложена в самом названии.
Марш против Батюшок. In such a strong...
Я не держусь за мандат, я готов уйти. Но уйти, чтобы вернуться...
Мы должны помочь в реализации этой задачи. Мы хотим развивать...
A blogger and a billionaire. A firebrand and a socialite. A legislator and an economist. And of course, a punk rock collective. They've been on the cutting edge of the changes sweeping Russian society. Their profiles were raised and their images transformed as the political crisis deepened. They include political entrepreneurs hedging their bets, like former finance minister Alexei Kudrin and billionaire oligarch Mikhail Prokhorov. They include defectors like former State Duma deputy Gennady Gudkov and socialite turned activist Ksenia Sobchak. And they include hardcore oppositionists like leftist firebrand Sergei Udaltsov and anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny. And of course, they include people who've paid a heavy price, like the women of Pussy Riot. Some have taken risks and others have played it safe, but they have all, one way or another, been in the vanguard of Russia's political awakening. And the roads they have traveled over the past tumultuous year provide some insight about where Russia may be headed. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is my regular co-host, Kirill Kovrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
Kirill, we're quickly approaching the one-year point of Putin 2.0. The election was a year ago next month, followed, of course, by the inauguration in May. And this week, of course, marked the one-year anniversary of Pussy Riot's famous performance in Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral. We'll discuss that in the second half of the podcast. And I want to periodically take a look back at the developments of the past year in order to get some sense of where things may be headed. So let's take a look back at the paths some of the heroes of the political awakening, of Russia's political awakening, have traveled. And I guess let's start, I mean, we're not going to be driven by the news here. Navalny was in the news this week, but we'll get to him. Let's start with the political entrepreneurs, Alexei Kudrin and Mikhail Prokhorov. These were two people that were, that danced with the opposition and that danced with the regime. And in this sense, I included them in the discussion because I kind of see them as kind of key figures and key barometers as to where things were going. What roads did you see Kudrin and Prokhorov travel this past not just year since this whole period began? And what do you think that shows us about where we may be going?
I think that, and I see that Kudrin and Prokhorov now, all of them, they are in relative shadow. Political mm-hmm. shade.
Exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, they make very strong political gestures, especially Prokhorov. I think just few people noticed that Prokhorov wrote several, or some of his, aides wrote several blog posts in mm-hmm. his Life Journal blog, and where he criticized very strongly several initiatives by Kremlin, not by Putin himself. That's very important
yes.
and very interesting.
Both Kudrin and yes. Prokhorov have been very careful. When they criticize yes. the regime, they avoid yeah. criticizing Putin personally.
Yes. And then Prokhorov criticized, of course, first of all, Duma. This legislation about the adoption of
yes.
Children. And the second one, I forgot what's exactly. But anyway, he, of course, he cares about what to do and how to criticize, Kremlin.
He's very careful.
Yes,
yeah.
careful. But anyway, he is trying to prepare, as I understand, I don't know, of course, but I can, presume that he is preparing now a new sort of basis for a new political maneuvers in 2013, maybe in 2014. And I can see several such, political platforms for him.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's a total degradation of the context, of course, the total degradation of so-called opposition parties now in Duma.
Mm-hmm.
All these shameful legislations of last several months passed by Duma with the support of just Russia and communists and not just United Russia MPs and so on. So this degradation and the recent initiative by some just Russia members in the Kuban region, it's in South Russia, they proposed to close a rather famous rock festival in Kuban and to launch a Kazakh festival with all this, you know, patriotic paraphernalia and so on. It's not United Russia. It's not the initiative of United Russia or even by communists. That is the initiative of just Russia members. And now we see that this party and the communists, of course, I'm just, of course, I'm not speaking about Zhirinovsky party. It's
no
just,
need to speak about Zhirinovsky.
You know, so we have not such, you know, much time. But previously, in, you know, last year, United Russia, or in May, even in June, Just Russia seems to be not real opposition party, but anyway, decorative opposition.
What they originally were intended to be. They've gone back to their nature.
Yes. And that's the reason why I am saying that this system of, you know, decorative oppositions and balanced imbalance in Russian politics is broken. Is you know,
well, this it's sorry to interrupt you. This is I don't know if you read the Minchenko report this week. He came out with one of his periodic reports of
the Putin, second report,
Putin Politburo. But the most interesting thing to come out of the Minchenko report this week, I thought, was the prediction that the whole political system is going to be reset very soon. Putin's going to reset the system, and one of the things he may do is to have early Duma elections. And if you look at what's been going on in the Duma this past week with all the resignations following Navalny's revelations, and we'll get to Navalny in a minute, but this does seem to maybe open up the door for Prokhorov to play the role that you seem to be saying he's about to be playing. It's the role Prokhorov was originally supposed to play when Right Cause was first launched with him. So you think Prokhorov is kind of maneuvering to be the loyal opposition for now.
Yes, I am not claiming, but I think that there is some space for political space for Prokhorov's future, and he can enter this place and at the same time use this space and to be used by Kremlin on the spot. So there are several, you know, ideas about this. Or this is a very cunning plan by Mikhail Prokhorov to become, you know, a head of loyal but Russian opposition, liberal opposition, or, you know, creative class opposition, or,
and then maybe the successor,
or common sense opposition. I'd prefer to name it common sense opposition. Because now we don't have any, you know, trace of common sense in the all this Duma legislations and all these gestures by Kremlin and so on. The lack of common sense is the main problem of today recent Russian politics. So he could be a candidate for this common sense, you know, course, political course, and the Kudrin also.
Well, okay, yeah, I wanted to get to, what do you see? Because Kudrin comes out, his think tank comes out with these periodic reports, very critical of the government, but not of Putin. And he's in the shadows, but he pops out of the shadows every now and then. Keeps himself in the news periodically, but he doesn't get overexposed. What do you see? What do you see going on with Kudrin?
I think the difference between Kudrin and Prokhorov that Prokhorov could be a very successful public figure. And he was during the elections. Don't forget how many, you know, percent of the voters he collected during the, especially in Moscow, in Moscow. And Kudrin, of course, he is, you know, a financist, and he is not a public figure. He could be, you know, second in some duo. He could be the second in some duumvirato. He could be, you know, a very good political advisor or financial advisor. He could be, you know, a technical prime minister, by the way.
I think he'd want to be a little more than a technical prime minister if he were prime minister. Because
in public view.
again, in the Minchenko report, in addition to early Duma elections, Minchenko is predicting that that pretty soon it's really going to finally happen. That Putin's going to fire the government and bring in a new prime minister, and he mentions Kudrin as one of the possibilities. They may use a poor performance by United Russia in the next election, which would make the Kremlin look like it had a free election, because United Russia would lose, and then Medvedev could be blamed for that poor performance. He is, after all, the head of United Russia.
Yes,
get rid of the government. Kudrin's come up as a potential name that could be. He's the one of several names. Sergei Sobyanin, the Moscow mayor, also comes up as a potential prime minister. Rogozin comes up as a potential prime minister.
Prokhorov is a potential mayor of Moscow.
Yeah, because, there's all sorts of reconfigurations. Yeah. The point is, both of these guys are figuring in these machinations of the Kremlin that seem to be coming, but yet they keep their ties with the opposition. They seem to still have some level of trust among, and I don't mean the systemic opposition, I mean the opposition. Do you see them as trying to position themselves as bridges?
I'm not sure that we can speak about Russian opposition today as a whole thing.
We can speak in
the context of the discussion about Kudrin and Prokhorov. We can speak about part of so-called creative class in Moscow and St. Petersburg and several other Russian cities, and several culture public figures and scientific public science and humanities who are usually supporting mild liberals in Russian political landscape, from Marietta Chudakova to all these actors like Yermolenko and so on, and several prominent journalists. But it's nothing to do with the real strength of real perspective strength or future strength of Russian opposition, because future Russian opposition could be strong if it will establish itself in Russian province, in Russian regions, and in other social groups than so-called creative class. There, in these parts of population, Prokhorov could be stronger than Kudrin.
Yeah, yeah. One thing Kudrin's doing with the opposition, though, is he is building bridges with the opposition coordinating council. And there's been plenty of stuff on the blogs about this, about how he and Navalny he's been cooperating with Navalny's faction and with Ksenia Sobchak's faction on the coordinating council. So he's keeping himself plugged in with the Moscow creative class and with the opposition council, as it were. What about the defectors, Sobchak and Gudkov? Right. These are two people that were in different spheres, of course, but they both were part of the old system in one way or the other. Both were favored from the system in one way or the other. Both defected to the other side after December 2011 and as the protest movement broke out. How do you see how both of them have evolved? I mean, Sobchak began to lose a lot of her television gigs as a result of this. There was plenty of stuff in the press about how her entertainment career was suffering as a result of her opposition activities. Her mother, Ludmila Narusova, lost her seat in the Federation Council as a result of this. Gudkov lost his seat in the State Duma as a result of this. Never mind the formal reason that he was engaged in business activities.
You mean Gudkov Senior, of course.
Yes, Gudkov Senior, of course. Yes, yes, Gennady Gudkov. So how do you see the evolution of these two over the past period?
Don't forget that Ksenia Sobchak, she is a professional celebrity.
Yes.
Like Paris Hilton. And
but she's more than Paris Hilton.
Yes, of course.
She's
much more than
Paris Hilton.
But I adore Paris Hilton. Don't forget about this.
I think Ksenia Anatolievna would be very offended by that comparison.
I'm not sure. I remember all these political ads during the previous American elections with the participation of Paris Hilton when she, do you remember?
No, I don't.
She proposed to paint White House in
rose
because it's hot.
Yes.
And I'm returning.
But I take Ksenia Sobchak much more seriously than I take Paris.
Yes, but Sobchak, being celebrity, professional celebrity and so on, of course, she, I'm absolutely sure, she was dreaming about herself as, you know, this on a Delacroix painting as Liberty on Barricades.
Mm.
She participated in all this so-called revolution process because it was hot. In all the senses of this English word, it was hot.
I don't think that's the only reason she participated. The first, in that.
I didn't say that.
I think
was
she was
the
moved
only
politically
reason.
To
yes,
participate
but
in these
that was that was the first reason, but not the only one. The second reason was that she shares all this irritation against Putin's regime when they, you know, got a lot of, you know, money and so mm-hmm. on from previous period of Putin's regime. But she can't use this all these resources freely because mm-hmm. they feel themselves like, you know, in some golden cage.
Mm-hmm.
It's golden, but it's cage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the reason of this irritation. That is the second reason of her participation.
And the third, I would say, was genuine convictions.
Of course, she's witty, she's clever, and she can think politically. By the way, I think something about a month ago I read her article. I forgot where. That was a very good.
No, she's if you read her blog, she's
very thoughtful political analysis, and I'm sure that
she's very much her father's daughter.
Yes,
yeah,
I'm not sure that her father could. Write such articles in this way. I think she writes she writes better than him.
No, I would agree with that.
Being a celebrity and pop star, TV star, and so on, and at the same time political activist and political. Even political thinker, these two ideas, you know, they are not contradicting.
Not at all.
Yes,
but I don't think they
yes.
they are necessarily, they should
yes.
necessarily.
Don't forget, you know, all American history in the 20th century. Don't forget about, you know, Reagan.
Of course.
Ronald
yeah.
Reagan. So it's obvious. So that was, in my opinion, the reasons why she participated so, you know, wholeheartedly in the revolution 2012. Gudkov is another story,
mm-hmm.
is absolutely another story, definitely, because this is, I think, a part of some political game, the meaning of which we can't understand, you know, clearly. Because he connected very closely to KGB, you know, past, and he is, you know, a product, a fruit of mm-hmm. this system. And I don't know why he became a rebel. I don't know. Maybe it's a psychological reason. Maybe this is some kind of, you know, obscure political reason. Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, the result is that he was at some point, he was one of the leaders of opposition. And that was very important for opposition to have one of its leaders inside Duma.
Inside the Duma making trouble.
Yes. Yes. But anyway, that was a very two clever, absolutely clever gestures from opposition to make or to focus on Sobchak and Gudkov. Sobchak provided opposition with, you know, so-called
entertainment power
and views of so-called ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And Gudkov played his role inside Duma. That was important. And now opposition lost both of these.
Have they? I mean, they've lost Gudkov in the Duma, although I don't expect the current Duma, quite frankly, to be around. I do expect early elections. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm reading the tea leaves, and I think Minchenko's got his thumb on the situation pretty good. I think it makes sense, and just judging what we're seeing now with the massive the resignations from the Duma over the scandal that Navalny has exposed, we may just see a new Duma pretty soon. We may just see a new Duma pretty soon. Has Sobchak lost her megaphone? I don't know about that. You don't see her on the first channel, but you see her on Dosht pretty regularly. She's still writing her blog. She's still very active online. I don't think you can silence her, and she's still out there.
She got married, first of all.
Yes, she got married.
Secondly, now so-called revolution opposition, you know, activity is not hot. Is not hot. Now it's a mundane work.
Right. Now, her faction in the Coordinating Council, if I can believe what I read on LiveJournal, has been cooperating with Kudrin again. There's this whole fight within the Coordinating Council with Sobchak and Navalny's. This has been going on for months, but Sobchak and Navalny's factions wanted to find a way to kind of create evolutionary change, to find some kind of common ground with the regime to come to some kind of evolutionary change. That ran into the metaphorical bomb throwers on the council who want nothing short of regime change now. So she is playing a role. She's not. It's not so public as it was.
Yes, I am not claiming that her role is over. Her previous role is over, like, you know, this Liberty on Barricade. Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe now she's playing, you know, Margaret Thatcher or something like this. I don't know. Or Indira Gandhi. But definitely she's not playing Rosa Luxemburg, Clara Zetkin, and even Sivo. Simone de Beauvoir. She is now playing her role in the limits of this common sense. And I insist that this term common sense is becoming the main problem for recent Russian politics.
Well, this is, I mean, I want to pick up on that because this has come up twice. We talked about Kudrin and Prokhorov and trying to create a common sense systemic opposition. You don't say this about Gudkov, but Sobchak is kind of playing the role in terms of creating a common sense opposition, non-systemic opposition.
Yes.
Now let's move to the really hot ones. Navalny and Udaltsov. Navalny was in the news this past week for obvious reasons.
He destroyed Pechtin.
He destroyed Pechtin. He put the Kremlin in a very uncomfortable position. He put United Russia in a very uncomfortable position. Now nobody's talking about the criminal case against him anymore. I mean, for a guy who I wrote on the blog this week, for a guy who's the subject of multiple criminal investigations for, God, stealing lumber? What else did he steal? Cosmetics, according to the... I was reminded of the Brodsky trial when, remember, they accused him of stealing an airplane.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes.
And wearing velvet pants. That's actually in the trial. But for somebody that's under multiple criminal investigations, Navalny's having the time of his life. He's investigating the investigators.
Yes, but it's very interesting because I'm not sure that one man or one even such activity and, you know, elan like Navalny can do all these things alone.
He's not doing it alone. He has an army of online volunteers that are helping him. People are sending him stuff. And quite frankly, it's not that hard to look at the land registry in the state of Florida and see who owns what. I'm sorry, the United States is a very transparent country despite its drawback. If I wanted to take a couple hours, I could have found Pechtin's deed on the internet. I know people who have, for example. Some of them may be listening to this podcast.
Yes, but
I wouldn't say Navalny couldn't do this by himself. He's got a lot of people, a lot of followers online. He's all over Twitter. People are tweeting things. He even thanked all those that helped him in this investigation. I would disagree with that. I'd say he could. I know where you're going. You seem to be going that he must have had some inside help.
The question is why he focused on, you know, now on Pechtin, for instance, and not on, you know, some
okay,
other
well, that's
people.
A different,
yes.
That's a different thing.
And that is the question. And secondly, of course, all this activity takes a lot of time, even if he has numerous online volunteers and so on. Even in this situation, he must be online 25 hours a day, not 24 even. So I'm not, you know, claiming that...
So you think Navalny's being used, or Navalny's collaborating somehow with some faction of the elite?
I think both of them. It's like situation with Prokhorov. He can use the situation, and he can be used in the situation.
Navalny has his allies on the inside.
Yes, and
I don't think it's with the Kremlin itself, but he has his allies on the inside.
I'm absolutely sure, but I am not sure that his allies are, you know, liberals who want to, you know, get rid of bloody regime of Vladimir Putin.
No, and and if you look at what the behavior of his faction on the opposition of the, on the coordinating council, that is not what he's trying to do at all.
Yeah,
that is not what he's trying to do at all. Like I said, there's been plenty of stuff on the blogs about how he and Kudrin, this whole when Alexei meets Alexei meme, have been cooperating to a degree. So he does have one foot in the common sense portion of the, whatever you want to call it, the regime, the systemic opposition. What about Udaltsov?
He's still playing his role
as
a professional revolutionary, and he's still playing his role as, you know, the real, maybe the only one real politician in this country who is ready to go to the end in his fight against something or, you know, against the regime and so on. The only problem of Sergei Udaltsov that he's all his, you know, political career, he's fighting against but not for.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows what he's fighting for. Of course, he is head of some leftist group and so on, but he is rejecting now that he is, you know, an admirer of Stalin and so on. But that was previously. That was so previously. And he has not any, you know, positive program. Not just to get rid of all these thieves and criminals and so on, but what he is going to do with Russia. What he's going to do with, you know, economy, with science, with, you know, education, medicine, and so on.
Do you think it'll ever get to the point where that question will be in any way relevant?
That must be, you know...
Because with Navalny, that's a relevant question, right? Because I think Navalny is somebody who could...
Yes,
get near power.
Yes, but
I don't see it happening with Udaltsov.
Anyway, if you want to be a serious politician, even in Russia, you have to propose something to the population, not just a negative program.
Mm-hmm.
Program that this guy and this guy and this guy, they are criminals, and we have to, you know, fight with them and so on. He must propose something positive in, you know, for. Ordinary people. Not, I'm not speaking about ordinary people from lower classes. Ordinary people, that all of us. Mm-hmm. We, all of us, we are ordinary people. And we think about future, about our children, about our families, about our parents, and so on.
But the real question is, because I don't think, I just don't see Udaltsov, we're going to have to worry about that. The real question, what I'd like to get is, what's gone on with Udaltsov through this period? Because he went from being an obscure revolutionary to a revolutionary that everybody knows his name in this past year and a half or so. Like Navalny in a lot of ways. He went from being an obscure blogger to a household name, or as one analyst put it this week, a figure of federal significance. If you look at the Navalny and Udaltsov, what do you see their movement over the past year and a half? What do you see that signifying?
First of all, about Navalny. Navalny is, in American sense, is a classic muck wrecker. Muck wrecker, as it was in the end of 19th, the beginning of 20th
century. Upton Sinclair.
Yes, yes. But in a democratic country, this sort of activity will never lead you to, you know, political heights or to, you know, serious political positions.
Or to prison.
Yeah. Yes. You can end up in jail, of course. But anyway, you can't be a serious politician if you are muckraker, crazy muckraker in media. But in Russia, we don't have, first of all, we don't have normal media instead of online media. Secondly, blogs are the powerful instrument of political struggle and journalistic activity. And thirdly, there is no real politics in modern Russia. So everyone, a brave journalist or good finance expert like Kudrin, mm-hmm. or, you know, well-known and popular scientist, all of them could, or writer, all of them could become a political figure of some...
Just by doing something competent that would
yes.
be... Uh-huh.
Yes, because there is no real politics in modern Russia. And the space is absolutely open.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no rules for normal political life in Russia. That's why people with various political behavior, social behavior, or, you know, even media behavior can appear in this mm-hmm. space, because there is no any, you know, things or rules which could reject them from mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. area. You know, there are no any political codex of behavior. There are no political codex of how to do or how to, you know, behave in this particular political landscape and so on.
So Navalny's journey over the past year and a half
yes,
shows
from
us...
from Mark Recker to a real politician.
Uh-huh.
That is my idea.
And what about Udaltsov?
Udaltsov, he is still the only real politician in Russia, but he is lacking a positive program. That's why he never will be, on some political heights.
Right. But you can see, of these people that we've discussed now, you clearly can see Kudrin and Prokhorov on the political heights. They're both already
yes.
on the political
yes.
heights.
Yes.
Sobchak we see moving into the political heights possibly, or no?
But no, I think no.
I say possibly. I'm really curious about where her career is going to go. Navalny I definitely see.
Kudrin, Prokhorov, and Navalny. Just
yeah.
three yeah. of them. Definitely
yeah.
not Gudkov.
Mm-hmm. Gudkov is... All right, well, in a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at another part of the Vanguard. We'll take a look at the Pussy Riot phenomenon 1 year after the performance that made them famous and landed two of their members in labor camps. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian Service. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Was the song heard round the world when a group of young women entered Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral on February 21st, 2012, and staged an impromptu performance criticizing Vladimir Putin's ties to the Russian Orthodox Church. It sparked a scandal in a criminal case and landed two of them in labor camps, and it ignited a cultural war that still reverberates. Kirill, we've had a year to reflect on Pussy Riot's now famous punk prayer for Putin performance last February. How consequential was this act now in retrospect? I mean, it looked pretty hot at the time, and it looked pretty hot for a while. Looking back now, how consequential was this?
I think now we have Talakonnikova, Alekhina, and Samutsevich instead of Marx, Engels, and Lenin of Soviet times. This trio. I'm not joking, by the way, because...
You made our producer laugh.
I think that that was the most powerful act in Russian history for last, say, you know, 7 years.
I thought you were going to say Russian history, period.
No. 9 years, I think so. That's the most interesting thing. I think more powerful than even these mass demonstrations in Moscow in 2001. Because it was symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, demonstrations are very, or rallies, they are very protest, mass protest. They are very important, very important. In some ordinary political sense and mm-hmm. social sense. But you can see all this, you know, such events like demonstrations and riots and even riots and rallies in all the countries.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this in London, you can see this in Paris, you can see this even, in China. But The symbolic character of this punk, you know, play mm-hmm. or punk act or pseudo-punk, pseudo-act or pseudo-concert
that wasn't
yes,
a concert.
In this pseudo-sorry cathedral. don't forget, it was restored by Lushkov.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and it's plastic, not real. The symbolic significance of this act was that was, first of all, very fresh, very new for political and even cultural life in Russia.
Eduard Limonov, who turned 70 today, by the way,
he
has been doing outrageous things for as long as I can remember.
No, that was it's very interesting. That's very interesting.
I had to mention that today is Limonov's birthday.
He's very envious about Pussy Riot. That's why he's criticizing them all the time. And the other one is infamous Russian contemporary artist Avdiy Ter Aganyan. Do you remember this guy who cut the icons in 1990s something?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he fled Russia, yeah. And he lives, by the way, now in Prague. And he's also very envious about Pussy Riot. So I can understand why, because all of them, they think that, what's happened? We did all these things, as you told,
right.
Before, and no one, or almost no one, noticed them. But mm-hmm. why these three or four...
So you're saying it was the right act at the right moment.
Yes, first of all. And secondly, how it was made. In which context? Because it was not just an act of blasphemy, as it was in the case of Avdiy Ter Aganyan. That was not just the avant-garde act of some kind of, you know, radical art gesture like it was in Limonov's case.
Mm-hmm.
Because Limonov, he can claim that he's a very, very Russian writer and political leader and so on, but he's inside a Western European political radical tradition.
Mm-hmm.
This mixture of leftist and rightist mm-hmm. Ways of, you know, behavior, political behavior and so on. This with Pussy Riot act, that was something different, because they founded their act on the idea of Russia as an Orthodox country.
Mm-hmm.
That's why this blow was so painful for the elite.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they tried to do this, and they did this on the Red Square, do you remember?
Putin's Zasal, yeah.
Yes. Almost no one noticed even this. Because Orthodox Church... It's not because Russia is an Orthodox, you know, country. It's not Orthodox country. It's atheist country,
mm-hmm.
really. But this is a core of new ideology, state ideology.
They touched off, I'm not sure if this was their intention, but they sparked a cultural war.
I mean, yes.
What we call in America a cultural war, a war of values.
Yes.
Not culture in the classic art and literature sense, but they sparked a culture war where they were, you're on one side or the other. What you think of Pussy Riot pretty much tells you about what your politics are in Russia.
Yes, you're defining this Pussy Riot act press you to define yourself in a sort of real civil cultural war.
Mm-hmm.
If you are on the one side of this front line or on the other side of this front line, are you with, Patriarch Kirill and Vladimir Putin and, you know, ordinary people, so-called ordinary people, workers from Ural Vagon, Magmash, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. on, or you are with maybe... with some just humble Orthodox priests who asked Kirill to not to send these girls to prison.
Your wording is interesting. Asked Patriarch Kirill,
yes,
not to send,
because
these girls
that was the initiative of Patriarch, yeah. Kirill. All this process against Pussy Riot and eventually the verdict was the result of the pressure of Russian Orthodox Church on the state.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that Putin himself didn't want to do this.
It was certainly costly. Now, let's go through the same exercises we went through with Navalny and Udaltsov and Sobchak and Gudkov and Prokhorov and Kudrin. What does the what we've seen over the last year, now with the Pussy Riot, it actually is 1 year and a day from the day we're recording this podcast. Mm-hmm. What is this? What does this tell us? What we've seen? Because they're, you know, two of them are in labor camps right now. One of them's free. There's no sign that Lokin or Tolokonikov are getting out anytime soon. What does this tell us? What's the lesson of the Pussy Riot story over the last year?
I think that the story is going on, and it's not finished.
None of these are finished.
Yes, I predict.
But what does it show us? What is this? What does this show?
I think it shows us that, first of all, that the country is divided, yes, deeply divided, even inside the families. That's mm-hmm. why I spoke about some kind of civil cultural war.
Mm-hmm. I
because
know what I'm,
yeah. Civil war, it's a thing which divided even the families.
Mm-hmm.
Even the families. That is my first point. The second point, that it's very interesting because usually people consider so-called contemporary art as something, you know, ridiculous or something, you know, some rubbish and so on. Not interesting, not actual for them, mm-hmm. you know, in some distance. And that is a very clear example of the significance of contemporary art mm-hmm. in not just in a well-being, you know, Western society. Moreover, I think in the such countries like Russia or in China, don't mm-hmm. forget about this Ai Weiwei case.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of the best, well-known contemporary artists in the world. And he himself is an icon of a Chinese opposition. He is not a oppositioner. But in the eyes of Westerners, and maybe inside China also, he is ahead of those yep. who is opposing the regime.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, Pussy Riot plays the same role.
Mm. I think what this has shown is that Russian society, the very fact that we can speak of such a cultural war in Russian society now, the fact that the merits of this are being debated still a year after the fact, and that something like this can place you on one side of the barricades or another, shows me that Russian civil society is maturing. It shows me that Russian society is developing and becoming more sophisticated, unlike after the Soviet period when you had this undifferentiated mass. Russian society is becoming more differentiated this way. We're seeing, I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, but a progress in society, a maturing in civil society. Would you agree?
In some sense, yes, because if people can identify themselves with not just with you know, how much money they earn or something like this, but with some you know, some special things as their attitude to church, to, you know, traditional values, to modern values, and so on. Of course, in this sense, Russian society is maturing mm-hmm. because just when you are starting from the, you know, your initial or, you know, the primitive needs like food, you know,
right.
money and so on to some other things.
When you go
which,
up Maslow's hierarchy of human needs.
Yes, 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 yes. To some things which we can, you know, call values.
Right.
Values are not consists of, you know, money or bread or something like this. Values, it's an idea. When people begin to speak about ideas, not about, you know, how much they can drink or
right.
you know, something else, so they are maturing. They are yeah. maturing. And if they are maturing outside such institution as, you know, church and
yeah.
so on, they're maturing stronger and stronger and stronger because this is an individual act
yeah.
of maturing.
Yeah, and it's showing me that the power horizontal is beginning to get to a point where it can challenge the power vertical, because we're not talking about, like, and we're saying what you think about what happened to Pussy Riot. We're not saying people who agreed with what they did. It's that do not think they should have been prosecuted for what they did. And there, I haven't seen the latest polls, but this is a significant portion of society. It's not 10 intellectuals in Moscow and Petersburg.
Yeah.
It's a significant portion of society that whoever rules Russia will have to take into account now. It's an important constituency, and it's a constituency that, they were able to dismiss before. And this exposed that this constituency is there, and that Russia's and that it cannot be ignored.
And another problem, very important. Sorry for interrupting you. It's expose huge problems with the Russian Orthodox Church itself. And I am absolutely sure that these girls, they were prosecuted just because Putin terribly needed the support from Kirill before and just after the elections. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of political maneuver. And that was a very serious political mistake for Putin, because he, or his, you know, political advisors and so on, because they never consider this obscure event in Moscow Cathedral as a thing which can, you know, start such international anger and feelings against his regime and himself.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a judge, Putin. He was not a judge who, you know, who accused them and sent them to labor prisons. He is not, Putin is not Patriarch Kirill, who pressed, you know, the state and the judges to do this. He was on some distance from this, but he failed, and that was a mistake, because he lose more than he gained.
Well, yes, and another thing this shows is that, and we spoke about this in the podcast a few weeks ago before you went off on your adventures in the Great White North, but how Putin has lost his old Putin majority. Once he lost the creative class, he lost what Pavlovsky used to call the Putin majority. And as we discussed a few weeks back, he's trying to build a new Putin majority on this, on these conservative values, on these orthodox values, and it's failing. And the way the Pussy Riot thing has played out has showed that this has failed, because it's not a Putin majority. It's a Putin plurality, maybe. Yeah. But it's not a majority. It's showing the weakness in rebuilding this majority. It's clear what they're trying to do, using this conservative or orthodox rhetoric. At the time, and for a time, it seemed like the Pussy Riot case played right into their hands. But in reality, it didn't. It exposed that this effort to create a new Putin majority based on this is hollow, is empty.
Yes, because what do we mean when we speak about so-called conservative values in Russia? There are no such values in Russia, because the word itself, the term itself, conservative, it comes from the verb to conserve, to conserve something. Yes, but what had been conserved by these conservatives after 70 years of Soviet regime? Orthodox? No, definitely no. Because Soviet regime, you know, struggled with the Orthodox Church. What Soviet values? But it just opposed by the, you know, the wealth of this new elite and all these cases of Pechtin and so on. How can you explain that your worker from Urals party consists of these billionaires and so on? It's ridiculous. And thirdly, don't forget that the only platform for such so-called conservative values now, in for instance, in Western Europe, I don't know how it's in the United States, it's this is a yellow press and pop TV, like, you know, tabloid culture and so on. This is a widespreading thing in Western Europe and United States, and I think that advisors told Putin that he can establish his, political power in third term on these people who is reading, you know, Komsomolskaya Pravda, Moskovsky Komsomolets, Argumenty, Fakty, and so on. But the situation, the social situation, is absolutely different, for instance, in Great Britain, where, of course, electoral base of Conservative Party partly is among the people who is, you know, reading the Sun
right,
and Daily Mirror and so on.
They don't have a permanent majority.
Yes.
This is the thing.
Yes.
And this is, again, going back to what I'm saying, what the Pussy Riot case exposed was that we are moving towards normal politics because the divide that came out of this is kind of showing the political configuration of the country. And there's not going to be one majority that is permanent throughout the whole country. It's going to fluctuate if things continue to evolve. In my most optimistic moments, maybe it'll fluctuate like we have. And, you know, Labor's in power some days and some years, and the Tories are in power the other years. The Republicans are in power some years and the Democrats are in power other years. The Social Democrats are in power some years and the Christian Democrats are in power other years. Maybe. I don't certainly don't want to make any overly optimistic or naive predictions. But what this showed me is that the society is beginning to break down that way. And that's a positive sign.
In some sense.
Last thoughts. We only have a few minutes ago.
Yes. In some sense, this crazy act in this Moscow cathedral brought us to the idea of normal politics, of common sense. And that is my idea.
I love to finish the podcast on a positive note, so I am going to stop it right now. That is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for the great discussion, Kirill.
My pleasure.
I'd like to thank also our excellent producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.